I'm here with Jason from DocStop. Jason is the CEO, and I guess we'll find out if he's the founder of DocStop. I took a quick look at the site just before we started talking, and it looks to me like a site that's doing lead generation through providing free documents and free templates to people, which is an interesting model I've never heard of, but it actually sounds pretty smart. Before we talk about DocStop, Jason, why don't you tell us who you are and a little bit about where you've come from before up till now?
Sure. So I'm the CEO of DocStop.com. We just had our one-year birthday on October 30th. And before that, I was finishing up my MBA in law school here at Pepperdine in Southern California, which is by the beach in Malibu. And I'm a serial entrepreneur. This is the third company that I'm on, the first one in the web space. We're a venture-backed company, so Rustic Canyon, which is a VC firm in Santa Monica, is the venture capital firm behind DocStop, and we also have a lot of great investors from the LA community, including the co-founders of MySpace, the former CEO of PriceGrabber, the founder of Lower My Bills, the co-founding president of mpgree.com, and I just...
Who are the names of those guys? Like, do you have Matt Coffin from Lower My Bills?
Yes, it's Matt Coffin from Lower My Bills, Cameron Porzondani from PriceGrabber, Robin Richards from mpgree.com, Brett Brewer from Intermix, which was the parent company of MySpace, Michael Jones, who sold UserPlane to AOL, is one of our board members. So we have a good group of Los Angeles tech folks that are involved with DocStop.
Cool.
Yeah, and then I'm an LA native, so my parents live in the same house that I grew up in. That's about a mile and a half away from where I live now, and I went to high school out here, and I went to college in Santa Barbara once again by the beach. So I don't think it's any surprise that I moved to DocStop over down by the beach here in Santa Monica, right by the promenade. And that's probably a bit about me.
Hey, you like a surfer, dude?
You know, I am this third-year-old like Jewish kid from LA, and I have actually only gone surfing once. So I've lived for 4 years by the beach in Santa Barbara. I lived for 4 years. Well, I went to school in Malibu for 4 years. My office is 2 blocks away from the beach, and I grew up, you know, not more than 2 miles from the beach. And I
hey, when you did, you're ruining the stereotype. You should have long hair to be a surfer, dude.
I am. I think my days of long hair are over, though. I don't think those days are coming back. But
you landed in an NBA corporate society.
No, I'm farther from that. I'm in jeans and a T-shirt at work most days. But we do have actually like this big shower in our office that was meant for people that want to go surfing in the morning and then, you know, just be able to pop in the shower in the office and then start your day at work. So I may need to take up surfing just to justify having a shower in the office. Or some other activity, right?
I won't ask anymore.
Okay.
So what was it? You mentioned you started 2 out of 9 internet companies. What were the other ones?
The first company I started out of college was I was doing motivational speaking and corporate training. So I was both the president and the janitor and everything in between. It was just me. And I was 21-year-old kid with, you know, either too much confidence or arrogance or chutzpah, whatever you want to call it, and I basically just went around the country when I was 21 doing motivational speaking for high school students and college students, and I used to do sales trainings and communication seminars, and I spent about 2 years traveling the country in a different city almost every week or every other week just doing these seminars and presentations, and I did that for about 2 years, which was a really great experience. After that, I went to go work at a startup in Southern California, a non-tech startup, and I was the director of marketing and sales there, and then while I was going to grad school, you know, I spent way too long in higher education, considering the fact that I hardly ever went to class and was always working on business-related things. And so I started a consulting company with one of my classmates there, Michael Sheridan, and we were doing consulting for startups and small businesses in the Los Angeles area. And that's really where I got the idea for DocStop.
Okay. I'm interested, you talked about your investors. I'm interested to tell me a little bit about the LA scene. I know Frank Adante keeps saying, like, hey, you know, the Valley's cool and all, but LA's where it's at and it's up and coming and it's more fun and all that sort of stuff. What's your opinion of the LA tech scene?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time in both areas, so I make a dedicated effort to make it up to the Bay Area and San Francisco a lot. You know, by just pure numbers, Los Angeles has been, I think, over the last year or two, the fastest growing segment of venture investment. It doesn't mean that in aggregate the largest amount is here, but it's just growing at the fastest rate, and obviously it's been easier for us to grow faster down here than the Bay because there's been less of it. But there's a really burgeoning tech community down here. I think it's obviously different than the Bay. I mean, the Bay is all about that community and these Web 2.0 sites, and it's very much more like a singular niche and community down here. It's a lot more entertainment, a lot more mobile focused too. What I will say, I talk about this a lot, and I actually started writing a blog post about it. The stereotypical generic difference between LA tech companies and Bay Area companies is that Bay Area companies build these beautiful, amazing, great user experience products, but they have their head up their ass when it comes to figuring out how to make money. And the company down here in LA.
Like some of them even had this like hippie ethos, like you can't make money.
Yeah, very, you know, very, you know, Craig Newmark from Craigslist, right? And the companies down here in Los Angeles, you know, will build really ugly, crappy, shitty products, which is, man, they make money left and right, you know, and you're probably not going to find any better example, right? Like MySpace, like so many people will complain about that user experience, and you go sign in on the homepage, and, you know, it's hidden, and there's huge ads around it, and you have to, like, get a magnifying glass to figure out how to sign in. But, man, those guys are great at building the business and making money and monetizing visits, and, you know, so the kind of stereotypical difference, and obviously, like, it doesn't account for all companies, is that folks down here, you know, are deal makers and hustlers and good at making money and, you know, just make that revenue happen, but aren't that product focused and don't know necessarily how to build
it. I mean, obviously, this is in a mixed mind space. A lot of my bills are obviously lead gen focused. I don't know that much about PriceGrabber and what they did, but, I mean, aren't there a lot of fluffy companies in the LA area as well?
Well, what call them fluffy? I would say what your focus is on. I would say in general as a stereotype, right? And there's a reason stereotypes aren't accurate. Is what you defined is that a lot of folks down here focus more on money and business and a little bit less on product and user experience. And folks up in the Bay will focus more on product and user experience and getting traffic and reaching a critical mass and a little bit less on, you know, making money. And I think there's a lot to learn from both. Honestly, you know, there's really...
Do you know, you don't think it's just that in the Bay Area they're less concerned about because they can just get a bunch of capital, raise their money, and then not have to worry about it. Facebook as an example, so they can just go along and do their thing for a long time and then worry about it later if they get that point or just burn up?
I think it's just a matter of the pendulum swings back and forth and there's a time and place for everything. I mean, I think a perfect example is LinkedIn was a company that didn't focus on making money for a long time. I mean, they probably the first 2-3 years, I don't think that was their focus at all. And they really did establish themselves as the key place for professionals to be online, and they took all that critical mass, and they took all that traffic, and they took all that user engagement, and they added in what I think is a brilliant business model, right? And basically the idea that you can connect with so many people, but if you want to have access to all these other people, you need to pay, you need to be on a subscription service. Now, that only works. What?
They're still not profitable.
I mean, I don't, as far as I know, they don't share their...
Well, I mean, as far as I know, they're not, because they just raised another round, like, you know, within a couple of months.
Yeah, I would be careful of making the assumption that a company's not profitable because they raised a round. I know a lot of companies that are very profitable that raise money just because they had the opportunity to raise as part of their capitalization strategy going forward. What I think that they did really well is that they became the leader in that market, and they got an economy and skill that now lets them grow, right? And so not everyone has that advantage. Like, you can't always be the first in the category. And so what I think a lot of times people in the Bay will do is they'll try to, you know, go for a really big home run and be the first in the category and own it and raise a lot of venture capital money. And you can have a really big exit. Now, it's also more risky, and it's certainly a lot more risky in an environment like we're entering into now, and we've seen the last couple months. So I think the lessons that, you know, that you can learn from the LA-based companies will probably be really important, right? Like, make money at all costs, figure out how to keep your business afloat, be a really good deal maker. I think those kind of, like, I'm going to survive and make it at all costs attitude is going to be a really important lesson and skill set to have over the next couple of years. And then the pendulum will swing back, and people will have to really start focusing on users and user experience and virality and growth and building great
products. Well, I mean, fair point. And I'm pulling on user as an example of Facebook. I love using Facebook. I'm a total addict. Every $500 million, that's $500 million in money invested in the company. And to me, at this point, I mean, I don't like MySpace, and I want to deal with all of that. And I live in the Caribbean, and so High Five is big here, but that's kind of annoying as well. So Facebook's obviously a lot better, but man, it just seems like they could have put a little bit more effort into figuring out the monetization stuff. They don't have to do aggressive things. It could be just through better use of virtual gifts and things like that. I mean, the virtual gifts, the options that last time I looked at was you can buy one for $1 or you could buy 10 for $10. You might get 10 for $9 or something like that. I mean, there's a lot more things they could be doing, be selling things to people within Facebook that would fairly easily have enabled them to make more revenue and not have to raise $500 million in capital. It seems just like a massive amount.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, as a product of going to law school for 3 years, you often hear me, you know, talk about both sides of an issue, and so, you know, please excuse me, that's what I'll do now. But, you know, on the one hand, I think that's a very good point, and I think had they been more focused on making revenue from the beginning, I wouldn't say they wouldn't or shouldn't have gone out and raised that money, because like I said, whether or not you're profitable is just part of a capitalization strategy going forward. Just like profitable companies in the past, you know, will have access to a lot of debt, have it on their balance sheets. So I do think that they could have focused more on monetization and revenue from the beginning and thought how to integrate that. And I think that their valuation is really just a sign of the time. I mean, the bottom line is, the period that we've lived through in the last 4 years is unprecedented in modern economic time. There has never been such a free flow of liquidity and capital in markets. And what that means is when there's so much cash floating around, you lose a lot of common sense principles. And when there's so much growth and there's so much liquidity and capital, you make these crazy assumptions of how things are going to continue to grow going forward. So if a company grew at, you know, 200 or 300% growth year over year, you just extrapolate that out because all you're thinking about is these good times and maybe the name projections. And yeah, I mean, a $15 billion valuation for Facebook, which was higher than four at the time, is really probably pretty crazy. And I think there are a lot of reports right now that they're going to try to raise more money at less of a valuation than they did with that Microsoft money. So there's definitely that side that I think all valuations in the last 3 years were completely out of control, and I think that one of the things that we're going to face challenges with as entrepreneurs, as angel investors in D.C. are really going to come down on what they value companies as, because if there's no liquidity in the market, you know, or it's a lot harder to get an exit, you're not going to necessarily be able to get those half a billion, billion, $5 billion exits. You may have to settle for a 50 or 100 or $150 million exit on your company. And the economics of that are tough on VCs as it is, because they need these big wins in terms of aggregate numbers to carry their portfolio. But even besides that, you can't invest in a company at a pre-money valuation of $50 million and sell it at 75 and really...
Well, let's talk about that, because, I mean, you raised money. We need to talk through some of that stuff, but...
I'm happy against that. The other point of Facebook is the following, which is, if you just look at how people use Facebook, right? I mean, I think by all accounts, it's within the 10 most popular sites on the web, and it probably has a user engagement that's unlike any site, right? Maybe somebody goes to Google as many times a day for very different reasons. What I will say is, when you've built something that valuable, when you've really built a place that people live online, I mean, that's not something that you could take all the money in the world and do over. Like, if you gave the smartest people in the world $100 billion, they couldn't just build what Facebook did, and it's really quite a phenomenon. So what I will say is, there's a little bit of an X factor, a qualitative factor, which is, yes, eventually they're going to have to get to profitability, and they're going to want to stop raising money, and they're going to want to be able to grow the company month over month and year over year on cash flow and profits and have that go up. And what they've built is really pretty extraordinary. The fact that they've built an ecosystem and a community and a platform where people just spend so much time a day, that is really valuable. And they've got some smart folks there, and they're going to figure out how to make
really
money.
Valuable. It should be really valuable.
Yeah.
But we don't know for sure yet. It's not proven.
No, but
I mean,
investors
they could find out they can't monetize. I mean, as an example, you could say the same about YouTube, and Google's still having problems monetizing YouTube.
Absolutely, but that's what investors make a bet on. They make a bet on what you're going to be able to do in the future. They're not making a bet on something like this. You know, if you want a safe investment, go buy a piece of real estate, right? You're going to buy it for $10 million. It's going to cash flow.
Well, people might not agree with that in today's market either, but
in this market, all bets are off, right? I mean, You may not be able to get your money back on U.S. Treasury. So if that's the case, then, you know.
So a question. You raised money from the Lower My Bills guys. Now, those are obviously guys that know about lead generation. Did they raise money to start their company?
Well, we didn't raise money from the Lower My Bills guys. One of our angel investors in our first round was Matt Coffin. So just a small point of distinction. It wasn't Lower My Bills. It was Matt Coffin as an individual who was...
Okay, and he's the guy that started Lower My Bills, right?
And, yeah, they raised venture capital for Lower My Bills.
So they did start with an investment event?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that they were individuals that started off out of their own pocket, but they raised, I think, more than one round of capital.
Okay. Because that's interesting, because, I mean, they're a lead generation company, and my feeling is, you know, the guys that I work with that have been pretty successful, they build their sorts of companies just for funded. And so I'm curious as to if you're around lead gen stuff and you have experience with the power of lead generation and how profitable that can be if it's done really well, why did you guys go and even start raising capital? Why not just self-fund?
So for us in particular, let me speak to it in general and I'll speak to us specifically. The reason that you fundraise, that you either take, you know, equity, and you give away stock and you give up a portion of your company in exchange for money, or you take out a bunch of debt, is because you think that you can grow your company at a faster rate with that additional capital, and that for that there will be a larger exit, right? Like you'll sell the company for more money, so even if you own less of it or if you have debt against it, that overall you as the founder is one that's making more money. So, yeah, I mean, my dad, you know, was an immigrant and came to this country and basically built up, like, you know, a small family business on cash, and everything he ever did was cash flow. And I never even understood it, you know, that there were businesses that you could start until I was probably, you know, started my MBA program, where it wasn't just that you made money and you saved a portion of that money and then reinvested in a business. So from our standpoint, yeah, I can't claim to say that I started off trying to do a lead generation business. I was 27 years old and I was running a consulting company, and I would spend hours a day looking for documents online, and I built up this really great repository of these digital documents on my own personal computer. And one night at 1 a.m., I thought to myself, shit, this really sucks. Like, it's really hard to find really quality documents. There should be something like YouTube or Flickr for documents. And that was, you know, literally probably 3 or 4 years ago. And then when my consulting company started winding down in my last year of law school, I just created this stocky little PowerPoint presentation that's on DocSoc. I think it's called, like, the history of DocSoc, which at the time was called DocBerry. That was kind of like Al Gore, right, when he went out with his presentation to save the environment and he turned it into a movie. Like, I just started showing everyone this, like, stupid 7-slide presentation that I created with, like, MS Paint, cutting and pasting pictures around the web. And most of the people said, hey, you know, that's a dumb idea. And some people said, that's kind of interesting. And it was more the people that said that they didn't like it. It fueled and motivated me. And I didn't really start off trying to create a lead generation business. I just wanted to build a place where anybody could get any document fast, easy, and for free. And I thought that if I could get enough traffic to it, and if it could be large enough, it would be disruptive, and I could sell it for some amount of money. So personally, I started self-financing. I was a student in law school. And at first, I was working by myself. And then I met Alon Schwartz, who came on as our CTO and the co-founder of DocSoc soon afterwards. And I maxed out my credit cards. I took all the money that I had saved up, which wasn't a lot, and I took out, you know, some student loans, and I basically just tried to build DocSoc with a firm overseas in India. And, you know, it was gaining traction, and people thought it was an interesting product, and then the stakes kind of started to heat up in general. And for me to continue it, I had to raise money. So I raised an angel round of capital for us as soon as I finished law school. And then once you kind of do that, you're on a path where, you know, we started building the product without making money day one, and it kind of put us in this realm where you know, it necessitated us raising money, quite honestly. Now, the difference was we built a product that started, you know, growing at a rate that was, I wouldn't say exponential, but it was different than most other websites, right? We're URL now, and we have over 2 million unique visitors a month, and again, both 10 million page views a month, and so it's growing, and people are using it. And it gives us the opportunity when we have that scale to make enough money and profit off it that eventually it's going to be a good acquisition target. So once you raise money from angel investors or once you raise money from VCs, you're on a very different path than any other kind of business. This isn't a business I can pass down to my children to run for the next 10 years. I mean, we've got to build this business up in terms of its profitability and engagement and usage and traffic, and then really in the next 5 to 6 years try to sell it off. So
one of the things that Alfred said on the call with him today, I was asking about starting a new company, and he said, look, you've got to be passionate about it. You've got to be really excited. It's got to be, because being an entrepreneur is hard. People make out like a business to be successful can be easy. It's not. And today you don't want to come in the office at all. And so you've got to be really excited about it so that you can drive through all that sort of stuff. Are you passionate about what you're doing?
Oh, I'm unbelievably passionate. Yeah. I mean, what I can say is it's the most challenging, toughest thing I've ever done so far in my life. And I have the distinct pleasure and reward of getting to say, there's nothing else I'd rather be doing in this world. I mean, I can really say that. There's
nothing.
So
why do you want to sell it? Why do you not want to grow? Or is it because the Zappos guys, for example, have taken a bunch of capital to build to grow Zappos. It's like plan on building it as a long-term business.
It just kind of depends within your DNA. I mean, I'm not saying that I want to sell it today. You know, what I am saying is that I like building things, right? I don't know that I'd be the right CEO for a 50,000-person company and running and has an organization and all of that. I think maybe one day I'd like it, but I don't think I'd like it now. What I enjoy is the process of building something and breathing life into it. And so I do like the idea that we're trying to build a company, that we have a goal in the next couple of years to try to get it to such a successful point in terms of its profitability and in terms of its engagement with people using it that we can sell it. And you also do it because you want to make the money, right? Like, if you can build a company over 5 years and sell it for X million or $100 million, and you have a significant portion of that, then as a founder, that's a pretty good proposition, because then it opens the door to do whatever you want.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
So the short answer to your question is, honestly, I didn't start DocDoc intending to raise money or have it be a business that was angel-backed or venture-backed. I was just trying to build this product, and I did it until I didn't have an ounce of money left, and I just needed more capital to keep it going, and that's where it did, you know. Maybe at some point in the future I'll be a repeat venture entrepreneur and raise lots of money and do that, but maybe the next business I do will be a totally cash flow business, and I'll put in a little bit of my own money and just start making money and we'll go it that way.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about DocDoc and how it actually works? I mean, I gave you my summary from a quick glance at the beginning, but maybe you can tell us a little bit more detail with what you're doing and what the plan is.
Sure. So the goal of what we're doing is to build up the largest repository of professional productivity documents anywhere. And the value proposition is that you can get any document you need, a legal document, a business document, financial, educational, a creative document, fast, easy, and for free. And so conceptually, it's similar to YouTube in that it's user-generated content. People all over the world upload their Word, Excel, PowerPoint, PDF files. You can preview all those documents on our site, and then you can download them. And so the idea is that there's a destination that for any kind of document you need, for any reason, you can come get fast, easy, and for free. And the way that we monetize this is, one, we have a lot of professional content, right? So we're good at capturing what somebody's intent is. Somebody comes to our site, and they're looking for an LLC operating agreement or a partnership agreement or an invoice template or a set of financials. We know a lot about what's going on in that person's life and what they're looking for. And so there's an opportunity to have really targeted advertising against those documents as well as do lead generation. So to say, hey, you're coming here for a legal document X or financial document Y.
Given that model, why would we even have advertising? Why not just do straight lead generation? Because, I mean, that's hugely, hugely, hugely valuable leads that you can generate there. Hugely valuable.
Well, that's really what we're working on right now. So maybe you need to come over to the DocDoc office and help us out with it.
I don't know about that, but it's an impressive model because that's what people need is leads. And, I mean, if you're generating those kinds of leads for an LLC or whatever else, someone's looking for an incorporation document or for asset protection or who knows what, if they're looking for free documents online, they're just getting started and they're right at the time when they need to make those decisions, and that's a natural thing to look online. It sounds to me like you've got a phenomenally powerful business model.
Well, I sure appreciate that. You know, we're still at the beginning phase of it. We spent most of the first year really just trying to build a good product with a revenue model in mind and grow the traffic. Now that those two things are going pretty well, we pretty much switched or refocused all of our attention to developing out as successful a lead generation model as possible. And so that's really what we're working on right now.
How does that work? So, I mean, let's say I'm looking to incorporate an LLC. And so are you effectively become a competitor for Nolo Press?
Well, Nolo Press is probably in a couple different businesses. Nolo Press is in the business of selling books and forms. And then they also, I think, have some professional directory, so I don't think we're a direct competitor. What I think that we are disruptive is anybody that's in the business of selling forms or templates or selling documents, we have the potential to disrupt the business. I mean, for me, I always thought that was kind of dumb, right, that people are selling the information that's already out there. Like, I remember I would do search for just basic kind of simple legal documents, and I remember my best friend in law school one day, he was looking for some kind of real estate agreement, like an offer to purchase real estate, right? His mom wanted to put an offer on the condo and looking for an offer to purchase real estate. And he put it in the Google, and he got all these kind of results, and there was some schlocky site that was selling it for $30, and he couldn't even preview the document, he bought it, and he's like, wow, this is crap. This sucks. Like, I wish I had seen. And for me, that's just, it's just a market ready to disrupt, right? Like, this information's out there. If you have any friend that's a lawyer or any friend that's a professional, a lot of times you can just email them and ask them to send you a lot of these documents that you may need, but not everyone has that friend, right? And there's nothing really proprietary about this information. I mean, there's a lot of, think of all the valuable documents. They're on your computer, right? They're sitting on your PC or laptop. Now, what if...
lawyers sending me mine, so I'd rather have the friend send me. But that, I mean, that raises a question, though. You may find all these documents out there, but how do you know what kind of quality they are?
Well, there are two things. One is you can see from the interaction on the site and from the community what's most viewed, what's most downloaded, what's highest rated, what's commented on, so you can get a sense from how people are interacting with these documents on DocSoc, what they find valuable. And the second thing is, it's really at your own discretion. We're not making a claim, at least not overall. Like, we're starting to do more editorial things and try to pull out and emphasize key content. So you'll see more of that on DocSoc over the next year. But what we're not trying to say, like, you should use this instead of this or this. It's just, here's a repository. You can get anything you need fast, use it for free. And we've built in metrics in the product so you can see what other people like. And the fact is, you know, I often knew what kind of LLC operating agreement I was looking for. So if I saw four of them, I could say, this is the one I want because it's got these clauses. Now, maybe not everybody has that. But a lot of people are more discerning when it comes to their documentation than you may realize.
The community feedback would help. I mean, I'd be, obviously, if you look at the community feedback on YouTube videos, they're pretty famous for not being very, very helpful. But in your stuff, I can imagine that the guys reading some of those, and maybe even attorneys, just going out and looking at stuff, and I can see them hosting, and that would give you some point of reference. So
yeah, absolutely. And not every document is a legal document, right? Like, you may just need a template to do a basketball certificate, right? You know, your son or daughter in the basketball league, and you want a certificate with a basketball on it. To give to all the people, do you really need a bunch of people commenting on that document or attorney to tell you what's good? No, you're going to look into what you like. You may be looking for a book in the public domain like Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn. You may want a PowerPoint presentation for a kindergarten or teacher that he or she could use to teach on ABCs or on counting. So certainly a portion of our documents, and specifically legal documents, the more vetting there is, the more editorial review there is, the more there is from the community, is a huge value add. And there's also a large portion of our content where people are quite capable of discerning just from looking at it whether it's something they want or not.
So the obvious question comes up, that happens with all these, how do you keep porn out?
Honestly, we don't get a lot of it. You know, on occasion, I think I've seen one or two documents in the last year, and we just deleted it. I think because people know that we're a professional site, we just really don't get it. Sometimes we get PowerPoints with, you know, a little bit more risque photos, and I don't really like those, so sometimes I look at them myself. But we don't really ever get nudity or pornography, and if that's ever on the site, like, we'll just pick it out.
Do you have any kind of clever filtering so that people can let you know if there's a problem? Do you like report this document? Or
yeah, on every single document page, there's a link to flag a document for any number of reasons.
And so what percentage of your documents end up getting flagged or having problems and have to be removed?
Very few. Very few.
So just the audience. Now, that's another sign that as a lead generation model, you've got incredibly powerful because you're showing the quality of the traffic you've got there. So tell me, like, let's say I'm looking at a document and it's how to form an LLC, and how do you capture my information and pass that on as a lead and sell it?
That's what we're working on integrating now. So that's what will be on the site on the first year. So part of it is I'll defer your question because some of it's a little confidential, and part of it is I'll defer it just because we don't have it done yet. But what I can say is if you go to the site after January 1st, you'll basically see it in there.
All right. Yeah, so, well, my one piece of feedback on that would be is as you're testing the implementation of it, I'd suggest you should be more aggressive rather than less and scale it back until you see what users are happy with.
That's generally the way I've done most things. My motto in life is... ask for forgiveness, not permission. And
if you've got 2 million unique a month, you can easily check your user engagement on site and monitor that very quickly, and then test it. Because by what you're describing me, you can be sitting on an absolute goal line. You could have the Google AdWords of documents and lead generation.
Well, thanks. You know, it's basically what we're saying earlier. There's a balance, right? I mean, we've got users and people who use the site, and we want to build a product that's engaging and useful and helpful to them, and then we want to make money. And so my nature is probably a little bit more of the LA guy, right, the deal maker, trying to figure out how and where to make money and build a sustainable business. And then I definitely want to build as valuable and great a product as possible. But I agree. I mean, our responsibility to all the employees and the shareholders is to build a really thriving, profitable business and double test anything and everything we need to figure out what's the best way that we can add value and make money for adding that value.
Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense. What else can you tell us about the model? I mean, what is not considered a document? Is it a picture a document? Is it a video a document? Like, where's the limit? An audio file?
Probably it's what you said. I mean, audio files aren't documents, and videos aren't documents. If something can live within a document, it makes sense, and there are. I mean, sometimes people just upload PowerPoints just of pictures, but they're cool. They're neat presentations, right? Sometimes people will upload a presentation that's, you know, the 15 strangest bus stations in the world. Is that really a document or is it a collection of pictures? I don't know, but I've enjoyed going through that presentation. Now, are we, you know, is there going to be some bus station lead generator that we're going to sell a lead to? No. But it's interesting content that people like. It's a lot of what people look for on the web. And so that's a portion of our content. It's certainly not the majority, but it's there.
Do you then become a repository for sites that are being promoted on Digs? So you then have to do with Dig effect?
We've been on the front page of Dig a lot. I mean, I love Dig. I think it's a great site. I bond to it for years to read and get alternative sources of news. And I'm a really active Dig user myself. I think you interviewed Andy Sorsini. He's a good friend of mine, and we met online, I think, 2 years ago. And I'm a really active member of that community. I just really like it. I think it's really fun. And a lot of our content has ended up on, you know, being highlighted not only in Dig, but in Reddit and StumbleUpon and other sites. And because we're a content aggregator, and because we deal in so many different topics, not just legal, business, and financial, our content has a way of finding itself all over the web. And we get a lot of people linking to us from blogs, and we get a lot of, you know, a lot of times our content gets promoted in social media. The other thing we're really well known for is a lot of sites use us to embed documents. So if you go to TechCrunch or Huffington Post or Chicago Tribune, they'll take documents that are on our site. A lot of times they'll upload documents there for the specific purpose of doing this. And then
that's you guys are the ones that are hosting those, is it?
Yeah. So the basic idea is, you know, I'm on neatinnovators.com and I want to show off this press release. Instead of having a link to say, click here to see this PDF of this press release, you can just preview that document right there on your site. And the value is it's just an interesting, better viewing experience for your users. It's not a paid view that no one leaves your site. And it's a lot of times just a better way to share documents. Not always. But, you know, for example, when the Senate bailout bill came out, right? The proposed bill for the United States Congress to bail out, you know, $700 billion for private industry, which is crazy. Huffington Post ran a story on it, and he embedded the bailout bill using DocDoc. When the California Supreme Court originally passed a ban against gay marriage, basically saying we're allowing gay marriage, although it's now gotten overturned, the Proposition 8, Chicago Tribune ran a story, and they put that court decision from the California Supreme Court in their post using DocDoc. And so we provide a platform that if you're trying to share, promote, or have documents be consumed by the public, we provide a variety of tools, and that being one of the most popular ones to allow you to do that.
So this leads into my question then. How do you get your traffic? I mean, 2 million uniques a month. Where did you start from nothing to get to that?
Yeah, traffic really comes from, you know, three main areas. I mean, I've got this whole philosophy on how you build traffic on the web. I'm happy to go over that with you. But we get traffic.
Yeah, sure.
So, we basically get traffic that people direct come to the site. We get traffic from a lot of referral sites. So, you know, I think right now we're in one of our documents is embedded in a TechCrunch post Eric Schoenfeld wrote about, you know, are iPhones better than Blackberries, and people see that and they click through to our site. We'll get traffic in a lot of just blogs in general that link back to us. We'll get, obviously, people coming to DocDoc looking for documents. And then also our documents get indexed in search engines. So, for example, if you go to Google and you type in LLC operating agreement, we're the first result, the first natural result, not a paid result, in Google for LLC operating agreement. So a lot of our traffic comes from natural search. And to your earlier point, that is a power, right? Is that, you know, imagine how valuable that is for a potential attorney to have the first natural spot for LLC operating agreement. It just happens to be a document that I uploaded a long time ago.
Do you search on LLC operating documents? Is it a paid ad or a natural search?
I think the term is LLC operating agreement. And if you put that in, you should be the first result.
Okay, yep, I see. And so have you spent a lot of time on search engine optimization for that?
We spend a lot of time building a good product, and we have the fortune of dealing in a file type that's text. So it's, in general, very easily crawled. It's a lot harder, obviously, for a search engine to crawl audio or video or pictures. How do you do that? We happen to deal in content that search engines can easily crawl. And, you know, for example, one of Google's missions is that they want to bring offline content online. So part of what we're tapping into is we're unlocking all these really valuable documents that have laid dormant and hidden on people's computers. And so it's a really symbiotic relationship. You know, you upload your document to DocDoc, you want a way to really easily publish and share it. You want a way to get it out there to the world. You want to either get a marketing benefit from it and have people see your content or refer back to your site, or you just want to help build a large repository of content like the Wikipedia effect. And then Google and Yahoo and all their search engines will crawl through all sites and say, aha, here's a piece of content we've never seen before, and it's interesting and valuable and cool, and it gets indexed in their results. I actually think that's the exact phrase that the search engine crawlers make. They go, aha, or so I've been told.
Did your dog.
I mean, you have not the slightest idea. Big, big
so,
dark.
Are you familiar with a company called...
How do you think I started an internet startup, dude? It's the one thing you can do that being the bigger dark you are, the more, you know, the more cool you are.
You to improve social life. You want to be able to go to the bar and say,
yeah,
hey,
you just,
I'm a computer geek.
You get to literally wear a shirt like, I am the biggest dark, and you're just the most popular person in the room.
Yeah, not totally. Have you heard of a company called Viewpoint Network?
I have not.
It's started by a guy named Matt I forgot his last name. I interviewed him a while ago. He used to run Cool Savings, which is a lead generation site. His company, Viewpoint Network, is a little bit like Opinions, but it's with a lot of social networking stuff built in, so it's a lot about sharing opinions on things. His aim and intent is actually basically identical to yours in that he's using his content to do lead generation. But he's come from the lead generation community already, so he really understands lead generation, like really, really in depth.
Great. I'd love an introduction.
Yeah, so he might be someone that would help to talk to you.
Do you think your audience would find it really interesting if we just talk about all the people that we meet right now?
No, probably not.
Probably not.
But I can tell you, I'll get with it later. So in terms of your traffic, now you mentioned, and this is an interesting point, you mentioned you're friends with Andy. I interviewed Andy the other day and we just published it, and it was, I think, one of the more interesting interviews I published. They obviously, the dig guys have this thing going on with, are you getting paid to do digs and all this sort of stuff. So firstly, let me ask you, are you on the top 1,000 dig ranking?
I don't know. I mean, the bottom line is I don't know. I have a pretty high percentage of stories seeing the front page. I think I submitted like 100 stories and maybe 30, 40% of them hit, so... Probably compared to other people, I'm doing pretty good. So I've never been approached by anyone asking me to. Maybe I'm just not good enough, right? Maybe other people are, but I never had a problem.
You plugged into this. You know, I'm talking with Andy. I didn't realize that the big guys are communicating quite a lot about stories and what's going on and where can you get content up to the front page. I mean, that, you know, it's what they spend a lot of their time on. Are you tied into that network?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of friends from Dig and other social sites and Twitter on my chat, and you know, they'll ping me throughout the day and say, hey, did you see, you know, this story broke, or this is what's going on, or I'm doing this event. I mean, it that's what kind of is cool, is that I've made friends all over the world just by getting to these communities. And you know, I had met Dig for years, and I really just like it as an alternative source of news for you.
I love to. I mean, yeah. Bring that 13-year-old immature boy in all of us.
I like that, and it also was just, there was that for sure, and also what I really liked about it too is it's just, there were news stories that you wouldn't see on, you know, CNN.com or the Drudge Report or Huffington. You know, you would just, it was a little bit, they would catch it a lot of times, you know, the user community would catch stories that were interesting that, you know, they didn't see. Like, I'm Jewish and I grew up in L.A., but sometimes they'd have, you know, stories from...
You know, by the way, you fit the profile of a lot of entrepreneurs. I think like 70% of entrepreneurs are Jewish. I'm a little stunned how many there are.
Yeah, I think it has something to do with the DNA of, like, your parents, right? They just, they both love and support you, but you're always, like, going after their approval. You're just trying to go for the biggest win possible.
I've noticed, I'm probably going to write out sometime, like the 10 brands I've noticed, but that's one of them. A lot of entrepreneurs, the ones that are successful, have gotten into Ayn Rand. There's a bunch of them, but that's, yeah. So
yeah, you know, I mean, I read all their stuff and called it. I love that. I've got her books. I think there is something, you know, that's passed on culturally, right? I mean, for example, I never saw my dad work for somebody. He just always worked for himself and tried to build up like a living for his family and take care of us all and make an impression upon you. You know, and when you don't see your parents going to work every day, you have a different philosophy of how you make money and how you grow yourself professionally and how you provide for your family. And so I think it's just a matter of, you know, it's a relatively small community in numbers compared to a lot of other, you know, ethnicities.
Yeah, but I mean, in entrepreneurship, the Jewish community is way overrepresented. I'm not Jewish, and I have no contact with the religion at all. I just keep noticing as I move up in business, that, man, there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff. Very impressive for a small group there. It's very well done.
Oh, I won't really try to take a claim or thing from
my entire
religion. But.
No, I mean, I like to change my list to Jewish. Anyway, so in terms of traffic, so you're tied into the Dig community. Is that helping you to promote your site?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, what it comes down to is people just get to know you and like you. So there'll be a lot of just, you know, because people know me as an active contributor to the community, and, you know, I'll take a look out for stories that I like from people that I think, you know, will submit cool, interesting things. And when I do like the stuff they submit, I'll dig in and I'll leave comments on people's posts. I mean, it's really just a very human thing, right? Like, if somebody sees me leaving a bunch of comments on their Dig stories and engaging with them and reaching out to them, they do the same to you. And so they're like, oh, who's this guy Jason? And what's this guy Doc stock? And they'll go there and they'll play around with him. And so I'm sure that, you know, by me being...
You're the CEO of a company that you hope to be able to turn around and sell for $1 billion, right? So you're interacting with a bunch of 15-year-old kids that are playing around on Dig.
Sure, for like some portion of my week, yeah. Just like some people will make, you know, model airplanes, and other people will go play basketball, and other people will, you know, go to movies. It's kind of what you enjoy doing. I mean, it's not the totality of what I do in my free time, but the fact is that I kind of am an internet geek, and I really enjoy diving into other people's products, both one, because it gives me a better sense of what builds a good product and what builds a good community, and two, I just kind of like it, right? Like, if I'm asking people to get engaged and use the DocStock experience, I'm not someone that does anything like that on the web. It's a little hypocritical, right? You know what I mean? It's a little bit more authentic to ask other people to do that which you like and do yourself.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it's impressive. So, I mean, your ties and connections into the traffic driver community has really helped you grow your company.
The day that DocStock went live, like one of our pieces of content made the front page of Dig, and our site got shut down for 20 minutes for it. I mean, that was all of a sudden a lot of people saw the site that nobody else had. So it's not a really significant portion of our traffic anymore. But yeah, when we first started out and you're trying to figure out a way to get people to know about you on, you know, in any and all way and you don't have a budget, the fact that you're tapped into a social media community and you know a lot of people that are evangelizers on the web and at blog and social media sites and get the word out virally, it's a really big deal. And look, I'm not trying to suggest that I just do this all out of like altruism. Like, I obviously really threw myself into figuring out how people drive traffic on the web to get as many people knowing about DocFox as possible.
Why do you do that and not have, like, you know, four people in team focus on doing that?
That's a good question. Well, part of it is what I just told you. I mean, I enjoy doing it. I don't really do it for all the business. I mean, part of it is I just enjoy spending some of my incremental free time at, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning when I'm bleary-eyed from doing work, just playing around on internet sites. I enjoy it. I like it. The other thing I can say is it's kind of like anything else where you got to do it for the right reasons, meaning if you just go on to one of these social sites and your only goal is to promote yourself,
no, obviously that's going to show up.
It comes out over time, right? Like people are smart and they catch on, and whether it's in person or over the phone or on IM or in chat, like, they kind of figure out your intentions. And so you can't just, you know, that's why you can't, like, a big company can't just hire people to go do this. It doesn't work. Like, maybe one time you can get one story to do well in one social network, but it's not sustainable over time. So my approach is, I like these communities. I like these people. I want to promote DocStock. I don't see any of them as antithetical to each other. And
do they ever come to you and say, dude, you're asking me to promote this DocStock tour again, but look, you're the CEO, and you've obviously got a vested interest in this. And, I mean, we're doing this for free, and we're not getting paid, but you've got financial incentive, so I can't promote it. Do they ever say that, or is that no big deal?
I can honestly tell you, like, I haven't got that reaction that much, because I think if the only time people ever heard from me was asking for help and on my stuff, and I didn't, you know, promote other stuff, nor did I offer to help people back in return with whatever they were interested in. Yeah, I mean, I would kind of just be a douche, right? No matter what it is, forget social web. Like, if you're just always trying to promote yourself and you never try to help other people with their stuff, or you never have any other interest in trying to promote yourself, you're kind of like the guy everyone wants to stay away from. And so
how does that work? You want help. So some guy says, hey, dude, can you help me promote these three stories? So you go on there, vote on them, and he goes and sends that out to everyone else. Is that how it works? And then you kind of reciprocate later to him later on? How does that actually happen?
I mean, I don't know how it works. I'll be on Dig, and there'll be different social sites, and there'll be different people I see that submit stories that I like their content, and so I'll probably pay more attention to it, and I'll go check it. And every once in a while, somebody will send me an email like, hey, I thought this was a cool story. They'll shoot me on IM. If I think it's a cool, interesting story that guy is meaning, you know, like, I'll check it out. I got time, right? I mean, it's relatively.
So you're getting less. So someone said, hey, you know, here's this story. Can you go dig it? That's getting one vote from you. I mean, that's a lot of work you can send an IM to you to get one vote. Or does that get leveraged because then your friends are likely to check it out because you voted for it and then it increases exponentially? Is that
I'm sure that's part of it, right? I mean, there's probably some people that watch out for the stuff that I do on different social networks. And if I do it, maybe other people will follow, just like other people will, too.
So how many, let's say you had a story that you want to promote, let's assume it's not DocStock related. How many people are you talking to about that? And what are you emailing them? Are you IMing them? Like, how does that actually work?
Well, I just kind of don't. When we first launched, I put in one or two things, and I just kind of drew a line. I'm like, for what you're saying, I don't really submit DocStock stuff. Like, if people know me and they do it because they like me personally or they like the company, that's great. And, like, any help or notoriety they want to do, like, I'm very thankful for it. But I don't put in my own stuff into social media. I just kind of draw the line there, or else I think people will get a little annoyed.
So you actually wouldn't promote, you would never submit a story of anything or calculated?
I typically don't. I mean, if there's like, you know, if there was like some breaking document I got, you know, like a, I don't know, if there's like, I found out that, you know, George Bush, you know, knew for a fact there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and there was a report written out about this, and I could get the document on DocStock and get it all over the web, yeah, sure, I'd do that. That'd be really cool, right? Like, we want everybody in the world to know about this really valuable piece of content that I found that I put on DocStock. But no, for the most part, I just don't, you know. I mean, there's also, like, the little fact, right? Like, I got a company to run. There's 13 or 14 employees here. I don't really spend most of my time on doing those.
No, I don't understand. How is the relationships you have in the Dig and Reddit and the other communities helping promote DocStock? Is it just because they know who you are and they're like, oh, that's Jason stuff, and I'll give that an extra bump?
Probably. You know what I mean? Like, late night when we're in the office and I just play around with those communities and I'm active and I go leave blog posts. It's the same philosophy of, you know, I spend a lot of time just reading other people's blogs. I mean, it eats into my time, right? I mean, this isn't stuff that I do during the business day, but, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night, 1 a.m., when other people are, you know, going out or drinking or partying, like, a lot of times I'll just take those hours to surf the web and look for other people's blogs, and I'll leave comments on their blogs or share their posts with other people I know, or I'll reblog on my blog about what they're doing. And, you know, people just kind of take notice, and they're thankful, and they check out what you do, and I can't say for sure what the incremental value is, but I know.
How many times have you been on the front page of Dig?
I don't know, probably more than like half a dozen, I would guess.
50 tons.
Yeah.
And what about like on Reddit or some of these others?
I mean, we get traffic from the sites. Like, if you look at our traffic at the end of the month, like, we'll get traffic from lots of social media sites. So and getting out there. I mean, remember, what we have is a content aggregator. We're streaming lots of different content. You know, so it's, you know, a popular site in the way that, you know, Huffington Post is, or, you know, an Engadget. The only difference is we're dealing in such a wide variety of content that it could get on there for any kind of number of things.
So do you think that it would be good getting on there if you weren't networking in the community?
Probably not as much, right? Just like you wouldn't get it in a blog post if I wasn't networking with bloggers. I mean, the fact is people will link back to DocsTalk if they see me as an active blogger.
That's more about almost brand recognition and knowing who you are, and then it's coming from that.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of it is just, honestly, authenticity. People just kind of bake at other people that are good folks and try to help them out. I mean, I really honestly don't claim to be the smartest or the best CEO. What I can say is I genuinely try to, like, you know, help out whomever I can when I can. I'm not always successful at it, but whether it's my employees here in the office, or whether it's people that come asking me for advice on how to raise money or start a business, or whether it's a 15-year-old kid that reaches me out of a chat and asks me to read some article that hears, you know, that he wrote, like, I'm generally trying to be like a nice guy. You know, I think in the end, if you try to be nice and good to most people, you know, eventually, like, it's just a better way to live. Like, you're happier, and it probably comes back on the end. And so, honestly, the best answer that I can give you is, whether it's in social media, whether it's on blogosphere, whether it's in trying to, you know, raise money, if you're just kind of down to earth and humble and not full of shit and tell people what you think you can and can't do, it's not necessarily always going to get what you want, but I think people should respond to you a whole lot better.
We talk about a lot of stuff. Is there anything that we haven't talked about you want to cover?
What I'd say is I think there are a couple really neat things on DocsTalk that we've done recently that I would just love anyone to know about. We really try to make it as easy as possible to help get your documents online. So, look, I know most people are not going to share their documents, just like most people aren't going to upload a video to YouTube or add a photo to Flickr. I mean, most user-generated content sites have less than 1% of people contributing, and that's why we're dealing in scale. And so the thing that, you know, what I'll often say to folks is, think of all the valuable documents you have on your computer, right? Now, what if all of us started sharing all these documents? And a lot of people say back, well, why would I want to share my documents? The bottom line is you may not. There are a whole lot of people that aren't going to share their documents. But there are some that are going to, and they're going to do it, one, because they want to, you know, promote their content. Two, because they want to promote their business or service or website. Three, because they want to just help contribute to the largest repository, you know. And if you talk to enough folks, they really get out there. And part of it, too, is if you just make the process easy for people. And so really what we're trying to do is there are just billions and billions of these invaluable assets that live in document forms. Word, Excel, PowerPoint, PDF, they're just hidden. Literally, they're trapped away on all these computers. And we're trying to free it all up. And part of what we've done is just made the process of publishing these documents to the world unbelievably easy. So you can go to DocsTalk and the upload process there is seamless, and it's sexy, and it's cool, and you can select multiple documents and do all of that. You can email any documents in DocsTalk. So one thing you can do that I think is awesome is that anytime you get an attachment in an email, if it's something you want to share, just you can forward it to upload to DocsTalk. Or you can select any document on your computer and just forward it as an attachment to upload to DocsTalk. It's just there, published for all the world to share. You can download this application that we have called DocsTalk Sync that's going to automatically scan your entire hard drive or any folder and upload all those documents, and you can either set them to upload publicly so all the world can share them, or you can set them privately so you can use DocsTalk as your personal online file storage for documents. And so we just provided all these really easy ways, and generally what I find is that when somebody just goes through that process, right, they just like, all right, I'll try uploading a couple of documents, and they find it to be really easy and painless, and they come back and check a site a week later, and they see that their document got, you know, a couple hundred, if not a couple thousand views, and it was downloaded, and some people left comments. There's kind of an aha moment. It's like, oh, I get it. Like, I can really easily take content I have and share it with the world, and then find other people's content. And that's what we're trying to do. And on the base level, we're building out.
So what's the motivation for someone to do that? I mean, I'll send my stuff, share my stuff with everyone for free, like, when there's a risk of having all my confidential data compromised.
So, yeah. So, first of all, a lot of documents you have nothing to do with your confidential data. And I'm not suggesting that you should upload your confidential data. Like, I don't think anyone should. That's not the point. But there are probably a lot of documents that you use or have on your personal computer that are really valuable and helpful to a lot of folks that aren't confidential at all. And the reason you do it is, one, because on all of those documents, there are links back to your websites that you can put on, right? Like, you can just upload a document under what we call a profile view, and anyone who sees these documents can automatically, you know, click over to your site. Two, a lot of times you're trying to promote that piece of content itself. So it might be a research.
So you're saying I could, like, put media and interviews up there?
Yeah, of course. You could upload, you know, 500 documents and then have links on all those documents back to your website, and it's just free referral traffic. The other thing is, you know, I gave you the example.
Are they no-follow links, or are they follow links?
They are no-follow. They are no-follow. I think we've done both, but they are no-follow. So you're not getting SEO views from it right now, but you still are getting referral traffic. The other thing is that it helps you rank for natural search, right? So you can take a bunch of documents and upload them to DocsTalk, and you may be the person at the top of search engines for a term that's really important to you. So I don't know, maybe you're Joe the Plumber, right? And you want to make sure, like, when somebody types in Joe the Plumber to Google, that you're the one that comes up. And so you upload your PDF of, hi, I'm Joe the Plumber. And, you know, all of a sudden now when somebody clicks on that link in the search engine, it takes to a page that's all about you. And so
yeah, you might outrank like Joe's original site, so that may be not such a benefit as well, wouldn't it?
I mean, it depends. Search engines are very smart. They have a way of figuring out what's the most valuable for a person. You know, if you're promoting Meat Innovators and you upload documents to Oxstock and call Meat Innovators, we're not going to outrank your site. Search engines are smart. They know that you're the primary source. But you may start to rank for all sorts of terms just by uploading your documents and then having the natural search lead one of your pages.
Okay, anything else you want to cover that we haven't mentioned?
No, I think that was... We think not about it. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
No, I'm glad.
Okay.
All right, Jason, well, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.